This is Space Time Series 27, Episode 31, for broadcast on the 11th of March, 2024. Coming up on Space Time, the oldest dead galaxy ever seen, raising new questions about galactic evolution. SpaceX looking at March 14 for the next Starship test launch. And the Optimus satellite launches, marking a new era for Australia and satellite servicing. All that and more coming up on Space Time.
Welcome to Space Time with Stuart Gary.
Astronomers have found a galaxy that suddenly stopped forming new stars more than 13 billion years ago. The study's authors, using the Webb Space Telescope, spotted the dead galaxy at a time when the universe was just 700 million years old, making it the oldest such galaxy ever observed. The galaxy appears to have lived fast and died young. Star formation happened quickly and then stopped almost just as quickly. And that's totally unexpected for a time so early in the evolution of the universe. The study's authors say it's still unclear whether the galaxy's quenched state is temporary or permanent, or for that matter, what caused it to stop forming stars in the first place. The discovery, reported in the journal Nature, could be important to help astronomers understand how and why galaxies stop forming new stars, and whether the factors affecting star formation have changed over the years. The study's lead author, Tobias Lucer from the Kavli Institute for Cosmology, says the first few hundred million years of the universe was a very active phase, with lots of gas clouds collapsing to form new stars. He says galaxies need a rich supply of gas to form stars, and the early universe was like an all-you-can-eat buffet. See, it's normally only much later in the evolution of the universe that we start to see galaxies stop forming new stars, whether that's due to a black hole or something else like a gravitational perturbation. Astronomers believe star formation can be slowed or stopped by different factors, all of which will starve a galaxy of the gas it needs to form new stars. Internal factors, such as a supermassive black hole or some sort of feedback from star formation, can push gas out of a galaxy, causing star formation to stop rapidly. Alternatively, gas can simply be consumed very quickly by star formation without being promptly replenished by fresh gas from the surrounding galaxy. That results in galaxy starvation. But the authors aren't sure if any of these scenarios can explain the Webb observations. Until now, to understand the early universe, astronomers have relied on models, well, let's face it, they're based on what we see in the modern-day universe today. But now that astronomers are seeing so much further back in space-time thanks to Webb, and they've observed that star formation was quenched so rapidly in this galaxy, models based on the modern universe will need to be revised. The authors determined that the galaxy did experience a short and intense period of star formation over somewhere between 30 and 90 million years. But between 10 and 20 million years before that point in time, when it was observed by Webb, star formation had suddenly stopped. Lucer says it seems that everything happened faster and more dramatically in the early universe, and that might include galaxies moving from a star formation phase to a dormant or quenched phase. Astronomers have previously observed dead galaxies in the early universe, but this galaxy is the oldest so far, just 700 million years after the Big Bang, some 13.8 billion years ago. In addition to being the oldest, this galaxy is also relatively low in mass. It's about the same size as the Small Magellanic Cloud, a satellite dwarf galaxy orbiting our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Although it's worth pointing out the Small Magellanic Cloud is still forming new stars. Other quenched galaxies in the early universe have always been far more massive, but Webb's improved sensitivity allows smaller and fainter galaxies to be observed and analysed. The study's authors say although it appears to be dead at the time of the observation, it's possible that in the 13.1 billion years since, this galaxy may have come back to life and started forming new stars again. The team are now looking for other galaxies just like this one in the early universe, which will help place constraints on how and why galaxies stop forming new stars. It could be a case that galaxies in the early universe die and then burst back into life. But the study's authors will need more observations to help them figure that one out. This is Space Time. Still to come, SpaceX looking at March 14 for the next Starship test flight. And Australian-based space machines company say their Optimus satellite servicing vehicle has safely reached orbit and is operational. All that and more still to come on Space Time. SpaceX is looking at March 14th as the likely earliest date for the third launch attempt of the company's massive new Starship Super Heavy rocket. The Starship Super Heavy is the world's biggest and most powerful rocket. It stands some 121 metres in height and generates some 16.7 million pounds, that's 74.3 meganewtons of thrust, almost double that of the world's second most powerful rocket, NASA's SLS, or Space Launch System, Orion Moon rocket. The new test flight from SpaceX's Starbase Launch Complex at Boca Chica in Texas will try to achieve orbital altitude before splashing down in the Indian Ocean. And that's different from the previous two launch attempts, both of which were aiming for a Pacific Ocean splashdown north of Hawaii. SpaceX were forced to issue a self-destruct order to blow up the launch vehicle during the first test flight back in April 2023 after the Starship upper stage failed to separate from the Super Heavy core stage 4 minutes into the flight. Several of the Super Heavy's Raptor engines failed to light up during the flight, possibly due to damage caused by debris thrown up by the rocket's thrust, blasting the launch pad into bits. The lack of engines during ascent meant the rocket simply failed to reach the speed and altitude needed for a successful stage separation. Instead, it entered an uncontrolled spin before stage separation due to loss of thrust vector control, triggering the activation of the flight termination system. The second flight back in November last year lasted a little bit longer, with stage separation using the hot staging technique successfully undertaken. The launch also saw the introduction of a new water deluge system as part of the ground support equipment at the launch pad. The good news is that during the climb to orbit, all 33 Raptor engines continued to fire for their full flight duration. But after hot staging separation and the initiation of the flip maneuver and boost back burn, several core stage booster engines began shutting down. That was expected, but one of them suddenly exploded, resulting in the destruction of the core stage. The failure was eventually traced to a filler blockage that led to inadequate inlet pressure in the engine oxidizer turbopumps. Meanwhile, the upper stage, or Starship, continued to ascend to orbit, flying for a total of 7 minutes until a leak developed in the aft section while a planned liquid oxygen venting was underway. That triggered a combustion event which interrupted communications between the spacecraft's flight computers, causing a full engine shutdown. And that triggered the autonomous self-destruct system to initiate. Flight termination happened just as Starship reached an altitude of 150 kilometers and a velocity of 24,000 kilometers per hour. The thing is, Starship becoming operational plays an important part in NASA's Artemis Man-Moon project. That's because a specially modified version of Starship, called the HLS, will be used as a lunar shuttle in 2026, rendezvousing and docking with an Orion capsule in cislunar orbit, and then transporting the Artemis III crew and their equipment down to the lunar surface and back up again. So not only will SpaceX need to show that it can launch, fly, and land Starship safely, it'll need to prove that it can do so multiple times, as several tanker versions of Starship will also need to be launched in order to refuel the lunar version of the spacecraft in Earth orbit for its mission to the moon. For SpaceX boss Elon Musk, it's all part of a much bigger picture. Musk sees the Super Heavy Lift Starship as a colonial transport system, eventually replacing the Falcon 9 and the Dragon capsule to carry humans not just to orbit or the moon, but onto Mars and beyond. Musk believes that mankind needs to establish a second permanent colony in space. With all humans living just on the Earth, it's a case of all our eggs being in the one basket. And that's where the Super Heavy Starship comes in. It can carry 100 people or 100 tons into orbit in one go, and therefore will play a crucial role in setting up colonies on other worlds. This is Space Time. Still to come, Australian-based space machines company say their Optimus satellite servicing vehicle is safely in orbit and operational. And 2024 is proving to be a spectacular year for sky watchers, with highlights including next month's total solar eclipse across North America and a series of four supermoons in succession in August, September, October, and November. All that and more still to come on Space Time. Australian-based space machines company say their Optimus satellite servicing vehicle is safely in orbit and operational. The spacecraft was flown into orbit aboard a Falcon 9 rocket from the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California as part of SpaceX's Transporter 10 mission. Following its deployment from the Falcon 9 upper stage, the 270-kilogram satellite will fly to its planned orbital slot and undertake a full testing campaign. Optimus is the first Australian commercial satellite to provide life extension services, inspections, and on-orbit assistance to existing orbital spacecraft. Space Machines Company says it plans to expand its orbital servicing vehicle fleet with further spacecraft launches. This is Space Time. Still to come, 2024 proving to be a spectacular year for astronomy, with highlights including next month's total solar eclipse in North America and a series of no less than four supermoons in a row between August and November. And later in the science report, the World Meteorological Organization says the current El Niño event is one of the five strongest on record. All that and more still to come on Space Time. Well, it seems 2024 is proving to be a spectacular year for sky watchers, with highlights including next month's total solar eclipse across North America on April the 8th. The lunar eclipse, which normally comes either 2 weeks before or after it, will be a bit of a dumper this year, because it won't be a full lunar eclipse. Instead, the event on March the 25th will be a penumbral lunar eclipse. That means the full moon will move through the faint outer part of Earth's shadow known as penumbra. Macquarie University astrophysicist Professor Richard Grace says this type of eclipse is not as dramatic as the full or even partial lunar eclipse, but it's still worth a look. Grace says other highlights of 2024 will include a series of four supermoons in succession on August the 20th, September the 18th, October the 17th, and November the 16th.
The concept of a supermoon means, in essence, that the moon is closest to us on its orbit around the Earth. The orbit is not entirely circular, so sometimes it gets a bit closer, sometimes a bit more distant. When it's a full moon, and the moon is at its closest approach, it's called a supermoon, and we have four of those in succession this year in August, September, October, and November. It's not that spectacular if you just look at the moon high in the sky, but if the moon is close to the horizon, closest to moonrise or moonset, and you look at it, it might look a bit bigger, and that's more like a psychological effect, but at least if you know, then it might seem like it. Now, we also have a blue new moon. A blue moon means that we have two full moons during a month, and so blue moons happen occasionally, but this year we'll have a blue new moon. So we have two new moons happening during a month. One is on the 1st of December, and one on the 31st of December. Now, new moons are obviously very difficult to see.
We can see Andromeda from where we are in this part of the world.
Andromeda is, it's visible from Australia. It should not be a problem. One should use binoculars, though, because it's very difficult to see with the naked eye, or rather impossible unless you have very good eyesight. And Andromeda is best visible in the latter half of the latter quarter of the year, from October to December. It's the closest large galaxy to the Milky Way. It's similar, slightly bigger perhaps, slightly more massive than our Milky Way, and so best visibility is, of course, when there is no moon. Right? It has to be dark, otherwise you won't see it. And it's relatively close to the northern horizon. Well, as I said, it's probably slightly larger and more massive than the Milky Way. It has lots of stars, but it's quite far away, and those stars are spread over a fairly large area. And so individual stars themselves don't contribute too much at the distance of the Earth. But together, it's like a faint, fuzzy thing, at a distance of about 2.5 million light years.
And of course, it's getting a little bit closer every day.
Well, it is getting a bit closer every day, but we have to wait about 4.5 billion years before we really merge with the Andromeda galaxy. So there is no danger of a collision anytime soon.
As a professional astronomer and astrophysicist, when you look up at the night sky, what does it make you feel?
It doesn't matter whether you're professional or amateur, I think. When you look up at the night sky, you're often captured by a sense of awe of what's out there, particularly when it's dark, of course, and you see all those objects, the stars, the galaxies, and you know what's out there. Right, so I'm not really a planetary astronomer, but I find it cool to see the individual planets, or get a pair of binoculars and look at the moon. That's all fantastic to see. I don't study it, but it's just a feeling that it's far away and that you're only a very insignificant part out there in the universe. That's quite a feeling, I think. That's actually what attracted me in the first place.
I love looking at the night sky from rural and country settings because you see so much more than you do from the city.
And you do.
The first thing I do is I either look for the Southern Cross or I look for Orion, because I use those as my sort of anchor points. From there, I can work my way across the sky.
Yeah, for me, it's usually Orion. I come originally from the Northern Hemisphere, so the Great Bear is more familiar than the Southern Cross to me. But Orion is visible from both the northern and southern hemisphere. So Orion, although to me it looks upside down, it's for me a great anchor point.
And if you look hard at the middle star in Orion's sword, you can see it's fuzzy. You can see it's not a star.
So yeah, just below the belt of Orion, or above it actually from the perspective of us here in the southern hemisphere, is a fuzzy block. It's called the Orion Nebula. It's probably the nearest region where stars are being formed. It's a stellar nursery. That's an area of research interest of my group, actually. So that's actually the closest area that we really study in any detail.
It's a spectacular region.
Yes, and you can see it fairly well by using a pair of binoculars or a small telescope. And so I recommend that people do so. Now, don't be disappointed, because on all those pictures on public outreach websites, you have the most spectacular colors, all kinds of reds. But in actual fact, when you look through a piece of equipment like binoculars, you don't see those colors very brightly. That's because your eyes are not that sensitive to colors at night.
Everyone wants to buy a telescope to look at the night sky, but you don't need that. You just need an armchair and binoculars, and that's all.
Well, it depends on what you want to look for, but binoculars are a good starting point, particularly for the moon, which I wouldn't really look at through a telescope, because the telescope only shows you a very small fraction of the sky. Binoculars are much better. The planets, the nearby planets, can be done with binoculars as well. But if you look at these conjunctions of planets, you don't even need equipment. And meteor showers, you shouldn't need equipment, because you won't be able to see them.
What are you working on now?
My group is working on the contents of very dense groups of stars, which we call star clusters. And at the moment, I'm working with a PhD student in India, working on ultraviolet observations, satellite observations with the Indian UVIT satellite, to try and understand how those stars formed and how they will eventually evolve.
Do you believe globular clusters are all groups of stars born at the same time, or are some of them the cause of other galaxies?
That's a very good question, actually. The majority of globular clusters in our Milky Way, and it's about 160 to 170 or so, are groups of very old stars that formed roughly at the same time. Different stellar masses form at slightly different times, but the differences are no more than a few hundred thousand years. Well, their ages are billions of years, so for all practical purposes, they're formed at the same time. A few of them, however, might be the stripped cores of what we call dwarf galaxies, and one of them is the object Omega Centauri, which is often portrayed as the largest, most massive globular cluster in our Milky Way, but it is likely that it was actually the core of a dwarf galaxy that no longer has the disk of stars around it. And that's based on observations that there are multiple chemical compositions of stars inside of that object, let's call it the cluster, and that is an unlikely result of stellar evolution. You need to have multiple episodes of star formation to form different chemical compositions, and most likely, therefore, that object is the core of a galaxy.
It's all in the metallicity.
Different metallicities, yes.
What are you looking forward to the most this year?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I like deep sky objects. It's cool to look at planets and the moon, but my research really is on much more distant objects. And there's a couple of them that we can see this year. We talked about the Milky Way as a galaxy visible during the winter, high up overhead, Of course, the Milky Way has a central dark area known as the Emo in the Sky by Aboriginal people, best visible in June, high up in the sky at that time. We talked about the Andromeda Galaxy, which is an object of that I'm quite favorable of. But then towards the end of the year, we might have a spectacular object, but it's not clear yet. In January last year, 2023, an object was discovered that is likely to become a comet. And that comet has the cryptic name C/2023A3, also known as Kuching-San Atlas. It will have its closest approach to Earth on the 13th of October at 71 million kilometers, but it will be best visible if it develops a tail, and we don't know that yet, about a week later, because the moon intervenes in the meantime. So late October, if that comet really develops a spectacular tail, that should be quite a spectacle to look for on the sky.
That's Professor Richard DeGrace from Macquarie University. And this is Space Time. And time now to take a brief look at some of the other stories making news in science this week with the Science Report. The World Meteorological Organization says this current El Niño event is one of the five strongest on record. Scientists say the event peaked in December and has been gradually weakening ever since. However, they say it'll continue to influence global climate over the coming months. Meteorologists say a combination of El Niño and climate change has led to record temperatures on land and extreme events, while ocean temperatures have also hit record highs. Scientists say there's a 60% chance of El Niño persisting until May and an 80% chance of neutral conditions, neither El Niño or La Niña, in April to June. But they are also warning that there is a chance of a La Niña event later in the year, but the odds are currently uncertain. An early-stage clinical trial has shown that a combination of two antibodies which target and boost the immune system are showing promising results against hard-to-treat solid tumours. The findings are reported in the journal Cancer, say the drugs known as CS1002 and CS1003 were trialled in patients with multiple types of cancer, including melanoma, lung cancer and liver cancer. The trials, which were split into three parts, found that in 61 patients who received the drug in their third stage, 37.7% had a positive response. The study also found that the drugs had a manageable safety profile. The authors say this early stage trial supports the idea of further assessment of the combination of different drugs for the treatment of solid tumours. New biosensing technology has made it possible to create gene testing strips that rival conventional lab-based tests in quality. A report in the journal Nature Communications claims the test can easily detect specific gene sequences in a sample, but unlike PCR, it can be done at room temperatures, using a test that looks exactly like the well-known rat COVID test. The authors say the test could transform human and animal infection control, as well as quarantine and biodiversity conservation efforts. A new story making the rounds claims that a painting, dubbed the Rain Woman, is the world's most haunted picture. Now, according to believers, the artist who created the painting felt something strange happening in the 6 months before painting it. It was in 1996 when she first started noticing flashes of light in the corner of her eye, but when she turned to look, nothing was there. But still, she felt something was always watching. Now, once completed, the artist put the painting up for sale at a local art shop. It was quickly bought, but promptly returned again. And the same thing kept happening time after time. Tim Mendham from Australian Skeptics says it could be the case of the artist having psychological or physiological problems, or it could just be that the whole story's untrue, even down to the actual existence of the painting itself.
The Rain Woman is this painting. No one's quite sure exactly when it was done. In fact, it was probably in the 90s, supposedly the story goes. It's a story that is transplanted, moved every time it's told, but there's very little basis to it. It's supposedly an artist named Svetlana Telets, who was inspired to do this painting of a fairly, I don't know, Modigliani-style looking thing about a woman and a body standing in the rain. She's got a big, broad-brimmed hat. The trouble is that no one knows anything about this artist. The only thing, if you look her up, the only thing you'll find is the Rain Woman painting and nothing else about her. So who she is, where she was, etc. Except there are embellishments that build big up extra stories. One is that she had this flash of light in the corner of her eye and she looked around, there's no one there, which might mean she has a problem with her eyes and her retina coming loose, which is a dangerous thing. If the story is true, you've got to go back to that all the time. If the story is true, the painting seems to exist, but you're not quite sure it's the painting that she supposedly painted. And it certainly, you can buy it on the net, you can buy prints of it, etc. But whether that's the painting that is supposed to be involved in this story, not quite sure. What she supposedly did was sold it, and it kept coming back because people, horrible things were happening when you bought this painting. Not the only haunted painting where that's happened to, by the way. We've had a number of stories about similar paintings that you sell it through an op shop or sell it through some sort of an antique store or something, and it keeps coming back. The owners keep bringing it back, which will raise the price of the painting eventually because everyone thinks, oh, good, haunted painting, I must buy that. But the trouble is that everything's allegedly in this story.
What makes this painting haunted? I mean, it's a lady wearing a black hat. The anguished man is much scarier.
Oh, yes. The woman in the rain looks pretty placid.
Yeah.
Looks like she doesn't mind being in the rain. There are certainly other paintings of people sort of out in the open who don't look particularly happy. This is not a very exciting painting. The question is, was it painted by this person? Did this person exist? The retelling of the story just follows and it sort of cut and paste, copy and paste the retelling without any information at all that's sort of verifiable. So we have to sort of put this one in the interesting. Is it really cursed? Do the stories about people, terrible things happening, are they real? This is a story totally without evidence, but it creates a myth and it's sort of very impressive to people. And it's really one of life's interesting non-events.
That's Tim Mendham from Australian Skeptics. And that's the show for now. Spacetime is available every Monday, Wednesday and Friday through Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, Acast, Amazon Music, Bytes.com, SoundCloud, YouTube, your favorite podcast download provider, and from spacetimewithstuartgary.com. Spacetime's also broadcast through the National Science Foundation on Science Zone Radio and on both iHeartRadio and TuneIn Radio. And you can help to support our show by visiting the Spacetime store for a range of promotional merchandising goodies, or by becoming a Spacetime patron, which gives you access to triple episode commercial-free versions of the show, as well as lots of bonus audio content which doesn't go to air, access to our exclusive Facebook group, and other rewards. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgary.com for full details. And if you want more space time, please check out our blog, where you'll find all the stuff we couldn't fit in the show, as well as heaps of images, news stories, loads of videos, and things on the web I find interesting or amusing. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgary.tumblr.com. That's all one word, and that's Tumblr without the E. You can also follow us through @StuartGary on Twitter, @SpaceTimeWithStuartGary on Instagram, through our Spacetime YouTube channel, and on Facebook, just go to facebook.com/SpaceTimeWithStuartGary.
You've been listening to Spacetime with Stuart Gary. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.